Well, thank you, Paul. I've been looking forward to this night for a long time, since, in fact, we set the series last fall. Those of you who've attended other programs in this series may have realized that in the short introductions to the evening's program, I like to try to put our guests in some kind of shared context, one that relates the guest to others who preceded him or her. Physician entrepreneur, a clinical leader, a captain of industry, one of the new breed of device executives, as we saw with Mike Baker last time. Well, anyone who knows tonight's guest, Steve Osterle of Medtronic, knows there is no context, no relevant comparisons. One of the most extraordinary minds in our industry, as I've experienced it, Steve was early in his career one of the most important clinical figures in interventional cardiology, during which time he left a lasting legacy, both training others and helping a host of small device companies bring innovative technology to market. 6 years ago, by an act of either brilliance or folly, depending on which side you are on, Medtronic lured Steve away to help transform the largest medical device company in the world into one of the most innovative companies as well. And even the term Renaissance man, I don't think, doesn't fully capture what makes Steve Osterle such a unique force in our industry. I think we're truly fortunate to have him here with us tonight. So welcome, Steve. Thanks for being here. Before we get into your career specifically, I mentioned before that you were one of the most respected interventional cardiologists. You always have it in your sights to become a physician? And was it all? Were you always aiming toward cardiology? How did you get on the path that got you here today?
Well, first of all, let me just thank everyone for being here. I see so many great friends out here. I'm kind of embarrassed and humbled that anyone would come to hear anything about what I had to say, David. But I'll give you a very short answer to that. So I started out as a chemist, actually, in college. And I had gone to college with actually very little verbal skills. And I decided to hide behind the international language of mathematics. And I pursued physical chemistry, but I realized at the time that I could not be a chemist because what I loved most in life was intimacy. I loved being near people and touching them, and so it became pretty obvious to me that the only place I could find applied science where I could find intimacy was in medicine. So I probably at the age of 16 or 17 realized that I was on my way to being a physician. I worked my way through college, actually, at the Mass General. I was a lab tech, and I was interested in hematology. And I had learned a lot about it, so I went to medical school with the notion that I was going to treat children with childhood leukemia. And I, in fact, left and went to Japan and wrote a thesis on radiation effects of bone marrow on late survivors of the atomic bomb, again, fully thinking that I would be a hematologist and work on leukemias. And then I realized that that was a little too intimate and that I wasn't really prepared to see kids suffer like that. And so I, like so many things in life, you're at a very impressionable age. I know there's a lot of young physicians in the audience here, and I think people, even the old physicians, know how impressionable it is to be a medical student. And I had been a medical student at Yale where the surgical department was really pitiful. And so I was sort of channeled into internal medicine by default. But I think I actually have a surgical personality and just didn't know it until I got to be a resident. And again, the people in hematology at the Mass General where I was training were so pitiful that I realized I couldn't really be like them. And the MGH, it turned out, had a really strong cardiology department. And so I started out thinking that I would, somewhere along the road, I thought I would be a cardiologist, and I was actually interested in electrophysiology. So I see Deborah Echt out here because in 1977, there was no such thing as interventional cardiology.
Right.
And so if you were a cardiologist and you were taking care of people with MI, it was a pretty boring thing. I think there are physicians in the audience who remember that the treatment of MI in 1977 was bed rest for 2 weeks. You could dangle one leg one day and dangle another leg, and this sort of treatment was stool softeners and oxygen. And so being a general cardiologist wasn't terribly interesting. Echo was just getting going. I actually was learning on a Smith-Kline M-mode echo at the MGH at the time. It was 1978, I think. And echo wasn't exactly very exciting to me either. And so I was interested in electrophysiology because it looked like people were doing things. They were just starting to do His bundle recordings, kind of probing around the heart, and that seemed pretty interesting. And I actually came out here in 1980 thinking that I would be an electrophysiologist, and like so many things, really, I, again, was impressed when I met John Simpson.
So before we get to Simpson, I like this notion of intimacy, because one of the things we're going to talk about is all the people that have come through your life and intersected. Tell us who Sam Thayer is and how he got you started on your career.
Yeah, so again,
because on the West Coast, he may not be as well.
So I don't know, does anyone know Sam Thayer here in the audience? I think maybe a few of you do. He's a pretty interesting guy. So again, this is really for the young students in the audience. And again, the older people will maybe understand this as well, that everything in life, I mean, is little tiny things happen that obviously send you off in a direction you had not planned on. And it's really who you meet and who looks after you that really, I think, in many ways determines what you end up differentiating as. Which is why I think, again, as someone like Paul, who we were talking on the way over here, how much I admire what he's doing and sort of guiding young people. And you have this enormous opportunity at a certain stage in your life to take people under your wing and set them in direction. So I was a medical student at Yale, and they hired from the Mass General the youngest chairman of medicine in the history of Yale. Sam Thayer came down there. He was 33 years old. Those of you who know Sam know that he subsequently was chairman of the Institute of Medicine. He was president of Brandeis. He's president of Partners. He's a very unusual person. But he's a very smart guy with a great sense of humor. And I had a certain degree of insolence as a medical student that not everybody enjoyed. In fact, I had at the time, I just failed general surgery for no reason other than I just couldn't stand in line and sort of take orders. And Sam Thayer, who was chairman of medicine, I think sort of recognized a part of me that he liked, and he sent me to the MGH, which in many ways sort of changed my life. And it was simply his decision to take a young person and say, look, you're a person who would fit in well at the Mass General. And so those of you who are physicians know we have this thing called a match. And so every medical student sort of signs a contract in their last year of school that they will go to wherever these computers match them. And so it's meant to kind of be fair. You list a bunch of places you'd like to go, a bunch of places list a bunch of students they'd like to have, and this thing gets ground through some software, and miraculously people get matched to the best choice of where they might want to go. That's the way it's supposed to work, but in fact, it, like all things in life, there's a subterranean activity going on. There's a lot of things that are going on outside the match, and there's prearranged matches. And so the MGH is sort of the quintessential old boys school. And out of the 18 interns that year, I'm pretty certain that probably 16 of them were pre-matched. And then the two really good interns actually came through the match from the University of Kansas and the University of New Mexico, who were the best students ever. And the rest of us were old boys. And so I came as an old boy, and Sam took care of me there. And really through my career, actually kept an eye on it and had a very important role in it.
So let's get to John Simpson. He's a figure well known here. Why did you come out here? How did you make that connection? And what do you think drew you and John together? Give us a sense of your impressions of him at that time.
Well, there's so many people in this room know John. I'm really sorry he's not here, because I'd like to tell you that I came here because of John, but the truth is, if anyone really knows me, that I came here because of a woman. And Ellen Finch, who was a resident with me at the MGH, and she was determined. I wanted to stay actually at the MGH and do plunge electrode work with Jeremy Ruskin. But Ellen wanted to move to Palo Alto, and I was at a point in my life where I said, you know, I'd live in a garbage can with you, just point the way. So we came out here together in 1980. Rich Pop actually recruited me from the MGH, and I, within months of coming here, Ellen and I split up for complicated reasons, and I thought, my God, here I am in a place I don't want to be. I really want to be in Boston. Mm-hmm. I have no interest. I only came here to be with this woman. She's gone. And I was really tempted to go back to Boston, and I sort of adopted a policy then that I oftentimes share with students also, that I'm convinced that when you're in a situation that seems absolutely wrong, that you just have to kind of rise above it and say, make the best of this. And I thought, you know, I'm here, there must be something good about it, figure it out. Mm-hmm. And so I showed up in the cath lab and met John. And anyone who knows John knows that he's an incredibly charismatic guy, very funny, lets you do whatever you want to do. And he sort of took me under his wing. And I sort of saw that he was doing this thing called angioplasty. It seemed kind of interesting.
Did you know what it was?
No, I never heard of it. Well, I had heard of it. I mean, so those of you know that in 1979, Grunzig published in the New England Journal of Medicine an article on coronary angioplasty. He had been working for a couple of years in Zurich, but most of the world didn't know it. John had known it. I think you all have heard the story of how he, in 1978 or 9, wanted to go to Zurich to see this, and Don Harrison wouldn't pay for him to go, the chief of cardiology. And Norm Shumway, the chairman of surgery, actually sent John to Zurich. While he was there, John was kind of watching Grunzig do his thing and saw that he was kind of having a hard time moving these balloons around the coronary arteries because they weren't steerable. And I was talking to Paul earlier today about his invention of rapid exchange, which seemed like a pretty simple idea that made a big difference. And John had a pretty simple idea, which is, you know, why don't we just make the wire move? It would make things a lot easier. And so John came back and was sort of toying around with that. Don Baim was working with him a little bit, and I got interested. And then John, for very complicated reasons, I'm not sure he divulged here, and I won't be the one to divulge it, decided to leave Stanford and go to Sequoia Hospital. And all my dreams of angioplasty went up in smoke then. And so I decided I might as well just go with him, which was a pretty bold thing to do at the time. So I left my fellowship after 1 year and went with John to Sequoia, where I met Carl Simpson, who's here somewhere in the back of the room, a lot of people. And John made me the first consultant to Advanced Cardiovascular Systems, which always makes me laugh because there was only one salesperson, Claire McCarthy. And I was with Jack Copeland this week, who's at the University of Arizona. That first year, Claire took me to Arizona, and we did the first angioplasty at the University of Arizona together, and John sent me on that mission. And we exploded the image intensifier. I think we had about 60 minutes of fluoro time, and it wasn't a pretty sight. Anyway, John and I spent a year up at Sequoia together. And remember, I hadn't finished my fellowship. Mm-hmm. And I think Paul maybe remembers this story, but I actually had planned to come back to Stanford. I wanted to be a cardiologist, and usually you have to do a fellowship to take the boards. And Harrison, in the most inexplicable way, kind of called me and bargained with himself and said, look, if you come back, I won't make you do any more of your fellowship. You can just be on the faculty. Mm-hmm. He never actually asked me if I wanted to come back and complete my fellowship, which I did. And so I did come back, and Debbie Atkins, people know that I skipped echo and EP and everything and just went right to cath without ever doing another rotation. I never heard the end of this, but that's the story. So John, you know, here's another guy who took me under his wing, and my life changed in all sorts of ways because of his 1 year of tutelage.
Did you personally have a sense, I mean, interventional cardiology and the catheter-based technology would transform medicine well beyond even cardiology. Did you at that time, at that early stage, personally have a sense of what interventional techniques would do for medicine?
Well, you know, I think, I don't know if I had, I mean, the amazing thing, I gave a talk a couple years ago at the American Association of Thoracic Surgeons, which is actually meeting in a couple weeks again. And the title of my talk was The Death of Cardiac Surgery. This was 2 years ago. It wasn't exactly well received at the ATC. They asked for it. And what I said at the time is, look, someone stood up and said, look, you've lost your mind. Do you think that cardiac surgery is going to go away? And I said, well, you know, let me show you a slide. And I showed him a slide of that time I was with John. And so in 1982, there were limited devices. So there was the DG balloon that some of you, maybe only two people in this room have seen, maybe three. But this was a pretty primitive concept. And then there was Carl's gig and Will's. This was the ACS catheter with a independently movable wire, but again, the wire wasn't torqueable at the time. It was a Cook wire that you had to kind of toy around with and mm-hmm. fracture just to make floppy. And that was the extent of interventional equipment. Mm-hmm. And so I showed that slide, look, you know, so the surgeons got up and said, look, you're crazy. Cardiac surgery will go on forever. I said, well, you know, back in 1982, this was the extent of medical device technology. And I said, if I had told you then that the following is going to happen, you would have said I've lost my mind. Then I showed him a slide of PFO closure by catheter device, PDA closure by catheter device, VSD closure by catheter device, percutaneous valve insertion by catheter device, creation of a portocaval shunt by catheter device. So we went through about 20 of these things, you know, VT ablation. So when Debbie Eck was at Stanford, Ed Stinson had a cottage practice in cutting out VT with a knife. Who would ever do that now? They were actually doing, I think, accessory pathways with a knife. And I said, if I told you that all this is going to happen, you would have said I'd lost my mind, but here you go, Jack. So I had a sense that there was going to be a lot of things going on with catheters. And one of the reasons why is that Carl and Will and Gary Curtis, a bunch of people had befriended this complete wacko named Jeff Hartzler. Mm-hmm. And so Jeff Hartzler was in my life at a very early age. In fact, did a very important thing, which was in 1984, I was recruited by Jay Holman to go to the Cleveland Clinic, and Jeff convinced me that that would be my death, and which was good, and that he talked me out of that. But Jeff Hartzler, as some of you may know, I don't know how many people here even knew Jeff Hartzler. So he's out playing a bass guitar in Kansas City at the moment, having a good life. And as I mentioned to Paul, one of the things that I admire about Paul is he could be out playing a bass guitar in Atherton if he wanted to, but he's being a river of generosity back to students. So not that Jeff isn't a generous guy, but he's doing his own thing. But he was probably, I think, the most creative genius ever in angioplasty. And Jeff and I were over in England, Carl will remember this, doing a demonstration course with Martin Rothman at the London Hospital, and Jeff was doing triple vessel angioplasty and suggesting that people should take care of MIs by angioplasty, and he got hooted off the stage, but I knew he was right, mm-hmm. And he was. So I think the biggest surprise to me has been percutaneous valves. I'm not sure I would have predicted that. I'll tell you a funny story about how unpredictable I was, and this is pretty embarrassing. But, well, there's two stories, really. Since Paul's here, I mean, I got involved for years in litigation about Paul Jaak because there was another guy named Bonzel in Switzerland who had also had this so-called rapid exchange idea. So I think most people know that Paul has this phenomenal invention that's pretty simple. Paul said, look, you know, instead of the wire coming out the end, why don't we have it come out the side? It was a good idea. And I'd already heard of the idea because I had seen Bonzel doing this. And so I had gone to Switzerland, and Bonzel demonstrated this, and I saw it, and I said to myself, why would anyone want to do that? And so I sort of dismissed that thing out of mind, completely out of mind. And so Paul independently, as who was working, I think it was a fellow still, weren't you? And I was in the cath lab, and Paul never talked to me about this, but I had never thought about it again. Because so the world, years later, was convinced that I had told Paul about this thing, and I, of course, had dismissed it out of hand as ridiculous. And never thought about it again. I swear today that I never told Paul about this, and I swore many times, way too many times about it. But I didn't do it. So,
you're being sued by Pfizer and Schneider on the other.
Well, so Pfizer was all over me, but they were convinced that I had somehow told Paul about this because I knew Bonzel and had seen Bonzel's idea. So the embarrassing thing, if you think that's embarrassing, is that in 1983. David, in one of the more inexplicable things I've ever done, I was invited to give a lecture on the history of angioplasty, which is pretty crazy because there wasn't any history. And this was, it was nearly 25 years ago. I was kind of a young guy, and I was invited out to the Carl Clinic in Champaign, Illinois. I'd never heard of it. I had some friends working there, and I was doing it as a favor to them, but the lecture was in honor of a guy named Cesar Gianturco. So how many people know Gianturco? So just a few of the engineers, right? So Gianturco is the inventor of the first coronary stent.
Right.
And he's a radiologist. He at the time was 80 years old. And they're honoring him because he's been there forever. And of course, he's not yet known for the Gianturco stent. And I'm talking about angioplasty. There's not a lot to talk about. We've got the Cook wire and ACS balloon, and that's about it, really. You know, I think a total of maybe 300 cases have been done or something. So everyone shakes hands, it's over, and I'm walking out of the room, and I go up to see Gianturco, and I shake his hand, and he's kind of a little guy, looks like Mr. Magoo, and he pulls this paperclip out of his pocket. Because, you know, Dr. Osterley, he said, I was thinking that we could put one of these inside the coronary and keep it open. And I said, let's see that thing. And so he hands me over this little kind of Z stent. It's a piece of metal, and I look at this, and I say, this guy's lost his mind. He's insane. And I'm thinking, be nice. So I said, no, Dr. Gianturco, that's a really nice idea, but I'm not sure that the body really wants that metal in there. He said, no, I think it'll work. I said, okay. And I walked away saying, the guy's crazy as a coot. He said, would you like to help me? And I said, sure. And he just kind of walked away thinking, I have to get out of here. And so he went to see Gary Rubin in Alabama. Of course, this is the Gianturco Rubin stent, which was a complete dog of a stent. The body didn't like that metal, but his idea was absolutely right, and I, of course, have dismissed this out of hand as insane.
I take you didn't tell the Medtronic folks that when you were about your predictive ability.
Well, you know, I've been wrong about a lot of things, really.
Before we move on, just you were at Stanford as you were developing the program at the time. You had just an extraordinary group of folks who were working, training under you, and working with
right.
you. You mentioned Don Baim's name. Paul was obviously there at the time. Who were some of the other folks who came through that program around that time?
Well, you know, it was an interesting time because John had just, so he had left, of course, for a variety of reasons, and around, ACS was purchased by Lilly in 85, Carl? 84. So I was running the cath lab, or the interventional program at the time, and so all the fellows, and that deal went down for, I think, $85 million, wasn't it, something like that? Plus a buyout. Forget it. Ron Dollins told you all about it the last time you saw it. So he embellished it, but it was a lot of money in those days. It's a lot of money in these days. And so John got rid of that old Fairlane station wagon he had and got an Alpha. And so all the fellows thought that was their destiny. And so the sort of the modern equivalent of this is that I come here every year and try to recruit from the Stanford School of Business. It's hopeless because everyone thinks that they need to go work for Google. And at the time, sort of ACS was the Google of every fellow's dreams. They all thought that they were destined to be just like John. And so we had people like Tim Fischel, who is kind of just like John, and Jerry Siegel, who some of you may know, who actually was very inventive his own way. Doug Murphy, don't call me Murphy Jatorian, was in that group.
Paul
Tierstein, PT-49. Do you know the story on PT-49?
No.
So Paul did his, can I tell the story?
Paul's
Paul Tierstein?
I think
so,
you all know my name.
If you knew him, you'd know how funny this is. So he was known as PT-49 by all of his residents when he was at the Brigham, because when they came in the next morning after he'd been on call at night, all the patients had a heart rate of 49, a temperature of 49, and a blood pressure of 49. He was killing them, so they called him PT-49. It stuck with him forever. And Tierstein could never be found in the cath lab. He was always over at the Daguerre pool with these young co-eds. And he like so many people, landed on his feet and did very, very well. But the character of all characters, of course, was Maurice Bookbinder. So Maurice and I started out together. Remember, I skipped 2 years of fellowship, so I ended up being a year ahead of him, which drove him nuts. And so when I came back to do angioplasty for Stanford, my first trainee was Maurice, but Maurice would never admit that he was trained. It was immaculate conception. And so some of you who were in the lab remember that he would also, I couldn't shake him. He was like a piece of sticky flypaper. I said, Maurice, it's time to train somebody else. And he said, no, I'm not trained. And this went on for like 500 cases, just went on and on and on. So Maurice, I think in his second year was given award. We had this little thing around the time of the Academy Awards where the fellows would give awards to the faculty, and Maurice received the award from the fellows for violence in medicine. And we probably don't have time to tell his great stories, but we eventually had to kind of send Maurice down to San Diego, which we did, and you can't put this in the magazine, but promise me you won't. But I convinced Carl to actually help fund Maurice's animal lab. Remember this, Carl? And so why ACS is funding Maurice's animal lab, he decides to come up with this VersaFlex gig. And it really put mud on my face and Carl's, but it was a good idea. So Maurice was part of that gang also.
At some point you went down to Southern California.
We did.
Good Samaritan. And then on to then back to the East Coast to Harvard. What was prompted each of those moves?
Well, you know, you can only stay in academics so long. I've had 3 goes at it. Now that's enough. It's a great thing, universities, but sometimes they don't move as fast as you like. And so the Good Samaritan Hospital, for a variety of reasons, fell into a lot of money. And they wanted to build the largest cardiac program in the state at the time. They were 19th. So there was a guy named Dave Canham, who many people know, who was down there, and he encouraged me to go down there with another fellow from Stanford, Joe Alvento. And we thought that the key to unlocking Los Angeles, because it was kind of weird, there wasn't a lot of organized cardiac activity going on. Everybody had little fiefdoms all over the town. We thought that what was needed there was a MASH unit. And so where you go downtown to the Staples Center, which is where the Good Samaritan is, if you draw a circle of 150-mile radius around Los Angeles, you incorporate 28 million people. So, which is the radius of a helicopter there and back. And so all we needed was a heliport, which was a problem because there was no variance for a heliport in downtown. There wasn't a heliport in downtown LA. So the good news here is that the chairman of board of trustees of the Good Samaritan Hospital is Charlie Munger, who is Warren Buffett's partner in Berkshire Hathaway. You may wonder, what in the world is this guy doing as chairman of the board of this little dink hospital when he's got other fish to fry? You'll have to ask him. He comes up here. I think they have a dorm named after him here on the campus. He's a philanthropist. But Charlie and a bunch of people convinced the city of Los Angeles to let these guys build a heliport for us downtown. And that's where I met my lovely wife. She ran the helicopter service. And we flew in around 7,500 people in the years I was down there, acute cardiac patients. It was an incredible gig. And we became the busiest center in California within 2 years, really, because of our ability to transport people around the traffic jam.
Now, did you go back to Stanford after, or go right on to Harvard?
Well, actually, I took a little detour to Georgetown. We can maybe skip that, but there was a reason for it. I actually thought we'd stay forever at Georgetown, and I went there because I'd been at Stanford, and I realized how hard it is to move an institution of this size. Georgetown's a nice little Jesuit place. I thought we could move it. I'd been there about 6 months when I realized that they were in some really interesting financial problems that are hard to see from the outside. And I came home one day and said, Adrian, look, Adrian, as much as we love Washington, which we did, and my daughter was born there, this is not a place to stay. This hospital is going to go bankrupt. Well, I was right about that. It took about 10 years, but Georgetown eventually did kind of go on the rocks. So Victor Zhao, who was here at Stanford, had basically baited me when I went to Georgetown. He said, you'll never go to Georgetown. You wouldn't do that. And he was trying to get me to come back here. And so I basically called him and said, you know, Victor, you're right. And he was a great chief to me, and he encouraged me to come back. And one of the most important things that he allowed me to do was to recruit Paul Yock and Peter Fitzgerald from UC, which it might sound like a simple thing. That was a very hard thing to do, actually, to get someone from UC down to Stanford. This is before the so-called merger. Mm-hmm. So these institutions were at each other's throats. And to kind of be able to take faculty out of UC and bring them down here was not simple. And Paul, of course, also had an unusual gig that he wanted to work half-time at the time, which seemed kind of inappropriate by the people in the temple here. Yeah.
At some point at Stanford, you built the first interventional device lab, and out of that came transvascular, cardiogenesis, Percusurge. Tell us a little bit about that story, and what in those days guided your decision to work with companies. Were you developing technology and building companies around them, or were the companies formed? What John Simpson had kind of created a model of physicians working with product companies.
Well,
what was your interaction?
Well, remember, before ACS, there really wasn't a device industry in Silicon Valley. Was there, Carl? I don't think so. Will? So these guys are sort of the Medtronic of the Valley, ACS. They, as if you go into Minneapolis, which is this incredible nexus of device companies, you can find everyone two separations from Medtronic, almost always. And I think the same thing's true here in the Valley. You can find people 2 to 3 degrees separated from ACS on almost every aspect of what's going on. But so when I came back, there had been sort of a renaissance of small device companies that had grown up in the Bay Area. And there wasn't really a lot of place for them to work. They had this thing called Babco. Margaret Toomes is over here, which was this Berkeley antibody company that was sort of this clandestine lab just off the Berkeley campus. But there weren't a lot of places to do large animal research. And there were a lot of small companies. And this is probably, Carl was, it's funny, they'd formed this thing called the Compass Group at Guidant. And they were spinning out interesting companies. Cardiogenesis was one of them. And they needed a place to work. And so, what they really needed was test pilots. And so, I don't actually think of myself as an innovator at all, which is why it might seem like a fraud that I'm here tonight. But I have tried to help other people innovate. And there were a lot of small companies that needed someone who was willing to sort of do a few of these on animals and then try them out on humans. And there's a pretty clear translation from animals to humans because the scale of both sheep and dogs and calves are such that if you get it right there, you should get it right in humans. In fact, the humans are oftentimes much easier than the animals. So, you know, I would actually give Carl Simpson, who's here in the back of the room, as much credit as anyone for kind of getting that device lab funded and going. And because it was so proximate to the Valley, it became very, very easy to do things here. Again, I think progressively over time, the university made it harder and harder for a small company's worker because they complicated the IP situation in an unseemly way, which is one of the reasons to leave universities, because they've gotten so confused about conflicts of interest and IP rights and stuff that it's become very hard to do industrial research in a university environment. Plus, this whole indirect cost recovery thing, it kind of blew up in Stanford's face. And again, I don't want to bring up a funny story, but that was pretty funny about how the Department of Navy got upset with Stanford over indirect cost recovery. And it really, we all paid a huge tax for that because it became the Sarbanes-Oxley of the time within universities for kind of marshaling over sponsored research. And since the device companies couldn't begin to understand why you would pay 1.8 times for a project, it was just never clear that they were paying for these beautiful buildings like this in the background of doing device work.
Well, what were some of the criteria that you used for working with companies or technologies at the time?
Well, you know, I think you try not to say no. Having both blown off Paul Yuck and Gian Turco, I decided not to say no to anyone else. And
passed on rapid experience.
Carl Simpson came to me with this notion of drilling holes through the heart with a laser. And anyone who heard that idea, everyone raise their hand who thinks that sounds like a good idea. That's a crazy idea. It's still crazy. But there was a group out there called PLC that was selling a CO2 laser. And so surgeons still to this day do this, but surgeons were blowing holes through the heart with this CO2 laser. It was direct vaporization. They blow through and through holes, and somehow this was like aerating your yard. This was supposed to work, right? And it seems, but I had the fundamental belief, which I still do today, which is anything that a surgeon can do can be done by catheter-based technology, even spine work. And again, I for a long time didn't believe that. I'd watch these guys put in plates and screws and rods for spinal fusion, and I said, well, that's one thing cardiologists can't do. You can do it. It turns out there's actually really interesting navigation and percutaneous technology that allows you to put plates and screws in. Any cardiologist could do it. But for sure, when surgeons are blowing holes through the heart by opening the chest, that struck me as really crazy. And so Carl and some of his buddies had this idea of cardiogenesis that we just come from inside the heart and blow the holes out the other way, dangerous as can be. But I was intrigued enough to kind of say, look, I think Carl Neuer said, I don't think this can work, but I'd be glad to show you that it can't. And part of, I think, our job in these device labs is to test devices that even when you don't think they maybe have any relevance. But it's really the Gian Turco experience and Paul's rapid exchange that taught me that, you know, you're not very smart, Steve. You shouldn't say no without trying.
So your comments actually about working at the university have a very contemporary feel. But in 1998, you went to Harvard. You went back to Harvard. And I know that you want to jump ahead to the Medtronic story. I know that you left Harvard in part because you had some frustrations with the pace of commercialization within the university community. Let me ask it this way. You came from the background of two of the most, if not the two most prestigious programs in the country. Why would you leave there to go to Medtronic?
Well, first of all, I did not leave the Mass General out of frustration. I left, so I think the real question is, why would anyone leave Stanford? This could not find a nicer place. And I loved it here. And one of the main reasons I left was that I had this sense at the time that biotechnology was going to be real. So again, this is 1998, and there was a lot of money going into therapeutic proteins, cell therapies, and I still do have the belief that within our lifetimes of most of the people in this room, that there, hopefully me, that there will be a realization of biotechnologies. And I thought that what was waiting was delivery technology. And I figured, again, with this fundamental notion that everything in the body has a vasculature, it's just a matter of going there, that if you have catheter technology, you can go anywhere in the body to any targeted organ and deliver something. And so Mark Fishman, who is chief of cardiology and is now head of biomedical research at Novartis, but at the time was chief at the MGH, actually listened to me. I said, you know, Mark, I think that we need to change cardiology and make this more of a biotech story, that this stents and defibrillators and stuff is going to be passe in our lifetime. maybe, and that we should start using transvascular technology to deliver biotechnology. And so I left here because at the time I thought there was a total disconnect between the engineering school. There was no bioengineering really at Stanford that was visible. And I had this kind of vision of Bob Langer and his merry bioengineers at MIT right across the river, the Longfellow Bridge from the MGH, and that I would just get on the red line and take the 2-minute ride across every day and do great things. And so I went to the MGH with the notion that I was going to be able to help realize some of the biotechnologies using the cath lab as a venue. And so we actually had a really good device lab there. We built a magnet in the lab because I thought, you know, if you're going to restore health with biotechnology, you're going to need functional imaging. And so I started working on tools to work inside of a magnet and deliver biotherapeutics. And I would have stayed there forever. I didn't leave out of frustration. I love Boston. I'm a diehard Red Sox fan for 40 years, and I thought, this is pretty good, too. And the MGH is actually a different place from Stanford. It's much more of a real clinical hospital. And so I was happy there. It never occurred to me that I would leave and out of frustration. But Medtronic came to me and one day and said, you know, we'd like you to come and help us sort out technology for this medical device company. Well, I actually didn't know anything about Medtronic. They didn't make, they bought VersaFlex of all things. I mean, they didn't really buy catheter systems. It was a terrible Vascher business. It still isn't the best, and it's going to get better. But, and I didn't know anything about EP, as Debbie can tell you, because I skipped that rotation. And so I didn't actually know that they made pacemakers. I think I did, but I didn't know much about it. I'd never heard of spine. I didn't know they owned diabetes. I had never heard of neuromodulation and never heard of it. And so they came to me at the Bullfinch building, the Mass General, and said, why don't you come work for Medtronic? And I said, yeah, right. Where is this company? And they said, it's in Minneapolis. And I went, ha! I said, you know, I'm not going to do that. But a little bird, again, the lesson I learned from Gian Turco and Paul, which is don't say no on basic principle to anything. Drugs, you can say no to drugs, a few things. But I mean, there are some things that you should say no to. But so Art Collins called me and said, look, why don't you just at least come talk to me about this? And I actually didn't know what he was talking about. And so I flew out to Minneapolis, and I spent most of my creative energy there figuring out how to get out of there and get back to the airport, because I really wasn't thinking I was going to stay. But the more I heard the story, I actually got sort of interested in that. When I heard that they had treated 5 million people with Medtronic devices in the previous year, that sounded interesting to me. And again, I had stayed in academic medicine most of my career with the belief that if you're going to be a doctor, try to have the biggest impact you can possibly have. And so you can only treat so many patients in a year, but if you train other people, then you're perpetuating the species in interesting ways. And it's the thing that I'm most proud of, is the people that I've trained. And if you do research, if you do something interesting, maybe you can help even 10,000 people. But where in the United States could you go next year and as a physician impact 5 million lives? And there's only one other place that I know of, and that's the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, and I'm not going there, and they're not asking me. So they're for sure not asking me. So
do you have a sense of why Medtronic identified you? And I guess the flip side of that question is, going to Medtronic, I mean, they had bought AVE a couple of years before you got there. They were not a powerhouse in interventional cardiology.
Why would they
want an interventional cardiologist to come and help them with a business that was increasingly becoming about spine, ENT, diabetes, and long-sustained cardiac rhythm management franchise?
Well, that's a good question. You may have to ask them. I think the answer is this, David, which is that, again, there are people in the room who know very much what I do, and it is the most interesting thing that a physician could possibly do. It'd be perfect with a few exceptions, which we could go into, but the great part of the job is this, which is that we have a company of 38,000 people. We operate in 120 countries. We have large businesses in neuro, spine, diabetes, vascular, cardiac rhythm management, ENT. And my job is to look external to the company and ask, is there stuff going on out there that we ought to know about that we should either have or be afraid of, while at the same time trying to rationalize internally our $1.3 billion R&D budget. Now, anyone who knows Medtronic knows that we're a highly decentralized, most Republican company. And so we have some friends here from J&J. It's maybe the other company that's like this. But when I took the job, Art says, come here. I want you to keep an eye on our R&D budget, make sure that we're spending money in the right way. He never told me how I would do that. And the fact is that it's nearly impossible to influence the internal R&D budget. You can, but it's gamed in all sorts of ways that make it very not transparent. And so I spend most of my time external, going around to visit and seek technology and sort it out and source it. So you might ask, where would you do this? And this is why I think they asked me to come, is these are the contacts that you need. And again, we have some of the brightest people in the world here from J&J Development Corp, so I'm embarrassed to even say this because they, of course, do this in their sleep. But I spend most of my time at technical universities. I know about technical universities. I've been in them, and I feel comfortable in them. I spend a lot of my time in venture world. I probably spend 30% of my time on boards of with other venture companies, some of whom we've been on boards together. And so we source a lot of ideas from the venture community. So you need contact in the venture world. I'd had that already through working with all these small companies. And I spend, curiously, a lot of my time in sort of the private equity world, which really surprises me, and probably the biggest surprise of my career, is how much time I'm spending with people who are running hedge funds and doing leveraged buyouts. But it's one of the most interesting things going on in the device world today is the sort of sneaking into the device world of the private equity world. And it's an interesting story. We could get back and talk about it. But I think they were looking for someone who had enough savoir faire to be able to conduct themselves without embarrassing Medtronic in universities, financial words. I spent a lot of time talking to investors on behalf of Medtronic. And so I think they were looking for someone who could do that, who was also a physician. And there are a lot of people who could do that. Paul Yock is on the short list every year. If you could ever get him out of California, they would have given that job to him.
So you said to me a while ago that, particularly as a physician, making the transition from medicine to industry was a matter of gaining some things and giving up others.
Yeah.
What did you have to give up in going to Medtronic, and what did you gain?
Well, what I gave up is very clear to me, and I think anyone in this room who works as a faculty member would understand this in a second, is that there's this incredible intimacy again in the hospital. And the intimacy starts with the patients. I mean, where else in the world can you go up and put your hands on people who don't know you and have them think something good's about to happen? No, seriously. I mean, anyone in here is a physician knows this. You've got someone who's sick, you go just put your hand on them. That's half of the game, is having them sense through your touch that you're going to try to do what you can to help them. Where else can you get 30-year-old graduate students who you can sort of beat up and make fun of, and they leave loving you, and because they know that your aim is true, you're trying to help them. So you're in a busy cath lab, and there's a lot of noise, and there's a lot of intimacy going on. You're touching the fellows, you're pushing them around a little bit, there's just this constant give in medicine. And you're giving with the nurses, the patients, the families. All that's off limits in corporations as far as I can tell. Maybe it's different at J&J, I don't know, Brad, but Carl, I don't know, he got pretty intimate actually, but that was that was in the 80s.
And that's a subject of a lawsuit that we were going to.
I'd been at Medtronic for about 3 months. I had a bunch of venture or finance guys from Goldman Sachs come visit me, and they were saying, gee, what's it like, Steve? How's this different from the Mass General? You want to know how this is different from the Mass General? I said, come out here in the hallway. And so those of you who've been to my office have known it's pretty quiet. And we went out in the hallway and we stood there, and I could see they were waiting for something. I said, do you guys hear anything out here? And they said, no. I said, well, that's the first difference. I said, if I took you to the MGH or Stanford, and we went out in the hallway, there's just a cacophony of chaos. Beepers going off, charts being thrown around, patients calling for doctors, doctors calling for nurses, emergency alarms, just noise, 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 noise. But if you put a high gain filter on it, you would hear people laughing. And they're not laughing at the patients, but they're definitely laughing at each other. And there's just incredible laughter going on in the cath lab. It's a constant joke. And so these guys, these bankers who weren't very funny themselves, looked at me and they said, well, why do you think that is? What's the difference? I said, well, it took me about a day to figure it out. The stakes are different. I said, in the hospital, it was just human life. Here we got the quarter, got earnings per share, we got return on net assets. There's a lot of things on people's minds here that are distracting them from laughing. So I think, you know, I gave up that.
So what did you gain?
So what I gained was sort of locomotion. So, you know, this is a company where the average product cycle time at Medtronic in our biggest business is 22 months, start to finish, from when they think this would be a good idea to they develop the product, do the clinical trial, and take it to the FDA and release it. That's 22 to 25 months. Now, so there's this sort of cadence of activity there that is stupefying when you think about Bill Clusen and some of these projects that go on forever and ever and ever. And so there is no cadence in a university. I mean, as long as you fund yourself, you can do whatever you want forever.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's just a little temple where, I mean, this is the whole concept. There is no concept. I gave up tenure, which is a really good thing, because I think tenure is somehow causes regression to the mean. And for those of you who are tenured, congratulations, and I'm happy for you, and I understand why there is a tenure system, and I'm not here to say that there shouldn't be one. But I don't think it's a healthy thing for companies, and I don't think it's a healthy thing for universities, but I understand why they do it. But I think tenure drives towards mediocrity in a way that you just don't see in a large corporation, so I gain that, is that we don't have, there are no tenured people hanging around doing nothing. And people sort of work at a very high cadence. When you have a $1.3 billion R&D budget, it turns out you can put bets down on things. So I can remember as a faculty member trying to get a grant for $150,000. When you got it, you thought all your Christmases had arrived on one day. Whereas when you have $1.3 billion, you can sort of carve out $2 million and no one seems to know that's missing. And you can, again, I don't want that written, actually.
Yeah.
But
too late.
I mean, so because the next thing you know, you have Blackstone on our thing saying, well, we'll take it. It's great to see sort of a global organization working at that speed.
Right. Well, I thought when I said before about the frustration at Mass General, at Harvard, I thought that's what you and I had this conversation a long time ago about how I thought that it was an element of frustration that in academia they don't have the same urgency to get some of the innovations out that they do in industry.
Well,
Medtronic has a much
greater
incentive.
So again, we've talked about a lot of things, David, that I didn't think I'd put on paper tonight, but we can, I think everyone understands this. I mean, talk about decentralized organizations. There's nothing more decentralized than a university. So again, I think one of the greatest things that's happened at Stanford is the BioX building and the biodesign program that Paul's put together, because that's actually an attempt to not decentralize things, but get people to, you know, work together in a matrix way. But that's very unusual for a university. And so most universities, I think everyone knows, operates on the basis of you get your funding, you do what you want to do, and you are sort of only subject to peer review. And that peer review can be a very small group of people, depending on what you're doing. So that if you're doing something kind of wacky, then the peers that can review that are actually part of a very wacky circle, and then it's a pretty small group of people, and it's not related to a large university other than everybody's on their own bottom getting their own funding. So that's kind of the beauty of product development, is that there's a Gantt chart out there, and people sign a contract on it that says that on this month they're going to deliver this product, and there's 100 people whose bonus for the year is tied up on whether that. So you just don't see that kind of mentality in a university, and of course that's fine. I mean, again, there's a reason that there are universities which are great, which is there's pure discovery going on in universities that are unimpeded by Gantt charts, which I think should be the case.
You know, a lot of people criticize large companies in particular for being too short-term focused, too much focused on the quarter. But in the last couple of years, last two or three years in particular, we've seen a number of prominent physicians go to large companies. Campbell Rogers went to J&J, Rick Coons went to Medtronic, Don Bain went to Boston Scientific. You kind of set the stage for that. Typically, the movement with physicians was to small companies. Do you think large companies have become a more hospitable environment for folks like you than academia is?
Well, I always felt welcome here, David, and I felt welcome in Boston. But I think there's sort of an evolving ethos amongst young physicians that it's okay to be part of industry. And that I don't think was necessarily true 10 years ago. In fact, I always thought I'd work for Boston Scientific, and when I talked to John Abley about it, because I lived in Massachusetts, my home was 5 minutes from Natick, and I talked to him about that one day by interest, and I said, look, I think I could really help you. And he said, Steve, why would you ever demean yourself by working for a company? And I think John still feels that way about it. He, anyone who knows him, he's a fantastic person, John Abley, but he really doesn't think that physicians belong in business. He'll tell you that if you ask him. I think what's become clear to me is that, so Rick Kuntz just came to Medtronic to run our neuro business. So those of you who know, Rick Kuntz is another interventional cardiologist from Boston running our neuromodulation business. Go figure, what would that be about? But I think this really tells you what the theme of devices is going forward is that one of the many patterns of change going on in the device world right now is that historically people brought devices out fairly quickly with a regulatory pathway that suggested that we will do what is necessary for FDA approval. And what's clear now is that those days are kind of falling aside, and now people are doing much larger randomized clinical trials because you can get all the FDA approval you want, but if you don't get reimbursement, you're hosed. And so we're finding that the reason we have 5 to 10% penetration in so many of our businesses is that no one ever invested in the appropriate clinical trials to prove that not only is this safe and effective, not only is it a good idea, but it ought to be the standard of care. So what was the first person, who were the first people to ever do that? Johnson & Johnson. So before 1990, there was no such thing as a randomized clinical trial in the device world. And so J&J, after Gian Turkel led the way, they said, that stent idea is not a bad idea. And they worked with Julio Pomaz, and they came out with the stent. And so the stent initially was meant to prop up arteries because 7% of these things collapsed. But they had a theory that maybe this would actually prevent restenosis to some degree. And so the only way to prove that theory was to do a randomized controlled clinical trial. They did 2 stress and Benny stent in the early 90s that actually established that this actually ought to be used on everyone. It was, I think, a very brave thing for J&J to do. And it actually set the style for all coronary work going forward, which any device that comes out in the coronaries now is usually scrutinized with a randomized clinical trial. But you're going to see that in every field of device work now. And so Rick Kuntz, you say, what's he doing there? He's the world's expert on, he designed virtually every clinical trial that was ever done in cardiology of any importance. And he is now trying to show that not only is sacral nerve stimulation a good thing for overactive bladders, but that actually ought to be the standard of care. So we have a $200 million business on sacral nerve stim for overactive bladders. It's highly effective. It has about, we have 85%, 90% market share with 5% penetration. What's wrong with the story? Well, no one ever did the trial to show that it's not only a good idea, but it should be the standard of care. So again, we had this wild thing called deep brain stimulation. How many people have heard of deep brain stimulation here in the audience? So I'd never heard of it. So I went to Yale where you don't take exams, and when we studied basal ganglia, I said, I'll skip that and go for coffee with Phyllis. And so imagine my luck to get to Medtronic and find out that we're stimulating the basal ganglia, and I've never heard of them. So I looked them up, and it turns out that these are the Cisco systems of your mind. They're routers. And it turns out that if you put electrodes down there and turn them on electricity, something happens. Now, not always good. So our job is, of course, to figure that out. But we have actually about a $200 million business in deep brain stimulation for movement disorders like Parkinson's. So those of you who read the New England Journal may have seen last fall that we actually finally did a randomized clinical trial that said not only is that a nice idea for Parkinson's, it should be the standard of care as class one evidence. So Rick Kuntz is kind of, as an interventional cardiologist, running our neuromodulation business, which was built from scratch at Medtronic with no randomized clinical trials, is going through the product cycles for all these things and sort of saying, look, not only is gastric stim for gastric atonia a good idea, it should be the standard of care. And that's going to be true for all devices.
You have a broad mandate at Medtronic, but I want to talk about one area specifically because you've actually been at the forefront of defining this concept of drug-device convergence. Yeah. You mentioned before that one of your interests, one of the reasons you came back to Boston was your fascination with the biotech community there.
Right.
And obviously, we're not talking about drug delivery technology like inhalers or patches and stuff. Just to give us a sense of the kinds of things you're working on, talk about the Alnylam project.
Right.
What is a collaboration with an RNA interference company have to do with Medtronic?
Well, it has everything to do. And so Paul and I were talking today about where I thought biodesign should be focused. I said, look, if you want to pick one thing, it's on delivery technology. And so I'll address the Alnylam issue and tell people what Alnylam is in a minute. But so I happen to believe that biotechnology is real, that this is not a dot-com, and that it will be realized because it's good science. It's just really hard. So if you broadly think about biologics as therapies, you're talking, for the most part, therapeutic proteins that works for Amgen, or protein interference, which is Alnylam, Cerna, a few companies, or cells, which has been really hard, which is Genzyme for the most part at this point, or genes. That's sort of biotechnology in a nutshell. Proteins, cells that make proteins, or genes that tell cells how to make the proteins, and that's what the story is, because all disease, for the most part, can be reduced to either too much or too little of protein. It's a long story. We'll leave it there. Think about it over a drink. But I think any disease that you want to talk about, I can show you how that's either too much or too little of a protein with virtually no exception. Fractures are not a disease. So if you just accept, just take that that's what biotechnology is, and then ask this question, which of those things, proteins, protein interference, cells, genes, can be ingested? I don't think any of them. You can actually trick them. You can trick the body by sort of coating these things with nanotechnology that gets them through the gut. But for the most part, these things cannot be ingested. They have to be delivered. Now, if you're lucky, like Amgen, you can get about $4 billion in revenue by injecting these things under the skin. Or like Medtronic has a $1 billion business in injecting a single protein, infusing it. This is insulin for type 1 diabetes. But this extremely low-hanging fruit. Most therapeutic proteins need targeted, controlled, local delivery. This is device-based. It's infusion pumps, it's delivery catheters, and it's navigation and targeting. So there are no exceptions to this. And so the biotech world, I think, slowly understands this. So Alnylam is a company that is based in Cambridge. Has anyone heard of Alnylam in here? So you should all go home and look it up. And the last time I did this, I got in terrible trouble. But I went to visit Fidelity with Art Collins, our chairman. And while we were there, I spent most of my time talking about Alnylam. And Art kept on kicking me. Because he said, you know, we're here talking about Medtronic. But I kept saying, look, right across the river is actually one of the most interesting companies you're ever going to see. So Alnylam is a biotech company that went public last year. And they have cornered the world's IP for the most part on small interfering RNA technology. Now, since you're here at Stanford, most of you hopefully know that one of your faculty members got the Nobel Prize this year for the discovery of small interfering RNA. This is nature's own way of suppressing proteins, since you don't want proteins just pouring out willy-nilly. The body has a natural way of silencing messenger RNA, cleaving it. So there's ways to make therapeutic small, these are 19 to 22 nucleotide RNAs that actually suppress proteins. Now, think of all the diseases that have too much protein, and you can start to see how this is a bonanza for them. But they have never actually proven in one single case that they can actually do this in humans. So if you want to prove this in a human, you'd want to pick the most targeted protein imaginable. So if you went through your lexicon of interesting abnormal proteins that cause diseases, probably the most flagrant one out there is Huntington's protein, which is a single mutant allele that causes an abnormal protein, Huntington protein, that is the proximate and only cause of Huntington's chorea, lethal disease. This is Woody Guthrie's illness. Arlo Guthrie, I think, has the gene. So that would actually be a pretty interesting place to test the hypothesis that these people are for real. So they actually came to us,
Alnylam,
as did Genzyme, for different reasons, and said, look, we need delivery technology or this will never be realized. And so their problem is that small interfering RNAs have to be targeted to the brain. And there's this curious thing called the blood-brain barrier that hates anything getting in, let alone 19 base pairs. So they said, we need a catheter and a pump that can deliver this for us. And so that is the basis of our collaboration. It's a 50-50 JV with them at the moment that's basically vetting our infusion technology and specialized neuro-based catheters and targeting navigation technology to deliver RNA interference into the brain for Huntington's. And we're doing this in primates at the moment. So that's the basis of the Alnylam collaboration. Genzyme, similar story. They actually had an autologous cell that they thought could heal infarcts. And they were already in a phase 2 trial in Europe in humans of autologous skeletal myoblast that were being put in by surgeons. So what's the problem with this story, Carl? It's like cardiogenesis all over. So I saw this and said, are you kidding me? You wouldn't open someone's chest to do that, would you? And so we thought that we could actually do this with the transaxis catheter of transvascular. And so Genzyme also saw it, as does anyone who looks at it, says that's the obvious way to deliver cells to the heart is through a transvenous navigation catheter that can target and deliver cells. So that was the basis of a very expensive joint venture with Genzyme, because we started funding a large phase 2 human clinical trial, which we stopped because it appeared to be futile. And so whether scaled myoblasts will ever work or not, I don't know. When we got into the JV, I said to Art Collins, I said, when's this product going to come out? I said, well, if it works, it'll come out in FY17. Well, you have no idea how that went down at Medtronic, because it's not even a number that's been said before there. No one's ever, at the time, we'd never used a double-digit number in any projection of any kind. And so, but I think what really bothered him was that not only did I tell him it was FY17, but there was enormous ambiguity in my response about, well, if it ever comes out. He says, what do you mean if it ever comes out? And I said, well, you know, I don't think this is the product, really. We're just going to try this out because autologous human skeletal myoblasts, these are the patient's own cells, and we're pretty confident they're not going to hurt anybody.
But that raises an interesting question, which is, obviously, I know one of the things you wrestle with and one of the things Medtronic, the device company, wrestles with is making all this real for Medtronic. Before we get into that, you once told me a funny story about teeing up a biotech company for Medtronic and sending it down to Mike Elwine's group for an evaluation on it.
So does anyone here in the room know how to calculate net present value? I'd never heard of it before, so I've been sent to so many punitive sessions at Wharton now that I finally got it right. And Art's on the board of overseers of Wharton, and so whenever I say something particularly stupid in the financial world, I get sent to Wharton. It's never enough to go to Kellogg or something nearby. So I figured out how to calculate NPV, and this is how we calculate. I mean, we have a lot of financial analysts, and every time we look at a deal, they come back and give us sort of, this is the deal economics. If you pay this amount of money, this is the NPV. And these numbers are generally positive. And so I sent some business development people down to a Midwestern city that will go unnamed, or you'll figure this out quickly, to look at a cell therapy startup company. And they came back and said, you know, here's the deal economics. And it had an NPV of minus $300 million. And I'm serious, minus $300 million. And so I'd never seen anything quite like that. And it didn't impress Art.
well, not favorably.
And so, but, you know, we didn't do the deal. So those of you who think don't short the stock on that, because we didn't do it. But I can assure you that that's the wrong number. It's not minus 300. It is minus, I think. But what it illustrated to me, and the point of the story I was making to David, this was years ago, was that how hard it is for this, there's a convergence going on. I was at the National Association of Venture Capitalists. Can you imagine they all got together in Washington this week? And we were talking about this convergence of into sort of combination therapies where you take devices and where's the relative value and whatnot. And one of the biggest problems for the device world is coming to grips with not only the timelines, but the scale of funding that's necessary for these things. So historically, an average device company that you want to take from scratch to a good company would be what, Will, 50 million maybe? Maybe less.
Yeah.
So now as you start talking about combination devices, so the deal with Alnylam, I'm not going to go into specifics, but we're talking about many factors greater to bring a simple product like suppressing Huntington to the market. And so I think everyone's aware of the scale of investment so that biotech is making and big pharma too. So device companies aren't used to those numbers. They're not used to the timelines. They're not used to the scale of investment. So what the lesson from this minus 300 NPV is that we didn't really know how to discount cash flow. Brazzling me like I've lost my mind. But I think you know what I mean. I mean, these guys were so conservative with it that they discounted this thing so badly that there was no chance. I mean, they basically said there's a minus 20% chance this will ever work. And then you do the calculation, come with minus 300, surprise. So, again, I think our business development people have never been as good, probably, as you guys at JJDC in terms of figuring out how to do really a realistic discounted cash flow. I mean, how do you know what the cost of capital is 10 years from now, really? Who knows that answer? And so you get these young kids from Wharton trying to figure it out, and it gets these crazy numbers.
So give us a sense generally of how your group and your efforts have been greeted by other executives at Medtronic, particularly the line managers who have responsibility to increase revenues next month and next quarter. When you stand up to speak, do they rise up and applaud with you, or do they roll their eyes and open their newspaper and pass quickly.
You know, I've had two sort of monikers at Medtronic. For the first few years, I was known as Dr. Dilution. I'm not saying delusion, by the way, dilution. It could have been delusional, but so, because again, I kept saying, look, when am I going to bring you an idea that's a creative out of the box? I mean, who ever heard of such a thing? And so everything that I do that would be viewed as strategic investment is necessarily delusional surprise, but it bothers people a little bit. But so I recently have been sort of known around the hallways as Rasputin, which is never a good thing either. But this is an interesting thing about a publicly held company, and I think everyone understands this, is that we have a market cap of around $65 billion, and our stock is held by a variety of people who have different expectations. So, I mean, there's a lot of people who hold our stock for our dividend. I'd gone into Art and say, quit paying the dividend. And he said, why would you say that? And I said, well, if you gave me the dividend, I'm certain that I could bring more value back to your shareholders than just paying them a check every year. And why would you do that? Well, I got sent to Wharton again, and so it turns out that there's a lot of funds that everybody else knew, I didn't know, that couldn't hold our stock if we didn't pay a dividend. It's part of the deal. And so, everybody has a different expectation. I think somewhere in the range of 15 to 25% of our stock is held by hedge funds. Now, go figure that out. I mean, we're a growth company. We're in for the long run. We've been around for 60 years. We're not that volatile. So why would so much of our stock be held by hedge funds? I can't tell you the answer to that. But I can tell you that when I talk to them about a product in FY17, they are really not impressed. So, meanwhile, there's this dialectic set up at the company because we're publicly held and we work under this quarterly reporting system where I think everyone knows that we have had double-digit growth forever, for a long, long time, and we promise it going forward. And so with double-digit growth, when you have $13 billion in revenue, this gets to be a really unwieldy thing for the businesses. So all the guys running the businesses, even Rick Coates, by the way, looks at me sort of cross-eyed because these guys are working as hard as they can to deliver quarterly growth. Now, how crazy is that, Debbie? I mean, when did you ever sit down, Paul, at the end of a quarter at Stanford and decide how well you did over the last 3 months? I don't think ever. Maybe you do, but I doubt it. And so we've got all these people running businesses who are trying to make targets, and then you waltz in, and you just got back from Oxford, and you saw this really cool deal that if we acquire now actually requires development dollars and a huge IPRD charge, which has to be taken right off of their P&L, because again, every one of our businesses carries their own P&L. And so even when I do a minority investment, you love this, Brad. I don't know how you guys do it, J&J, but when we make a minority investment, since I don't carry a P&L, I'm a corporate officer, I only carry an L. So if I make a bonehead investment, and the next round, the guys from NEA decide they're going to do a down round. Why not? Well, there's a lot of reasons why not, but one why not is that Steve has to trot back to Minneapolis and report this to Art, that we're in the midst of a down round, and because that's now an impaired asset, it has to be written down. But remember, I don't have a P&L, so it has to be written down off of someone else's P&L. We don't carry a corporate P&L for this, so it has to be written down off of one of the businesses. Imagine how happy they are that you've invested in something that's going to be written down on their P&L. So this is a very convoluted answer to the fact that we have a dialectic at Medtronic, and I think that everyone should be glad that there are companies like this where you have people like me who are out there trying to promote very long-term investment at a time when our businesses are struggling to satisfy the short-term expectations of so many people, really, including the sell-side analysts on Wall Street who watch us like a hawk. So this is an internal friction that I think is healthy for a company that is set up, and it gets vetted in front of the board, all sorts of people.
Mike Baker last time used the phrase tyranny of short-term expectations, speaking generally about large companies, but his view is shaped by his experience at Medtronic. Does that resonate with you, tyranny of short-term expectations?
Well, I think tyranny is a little harsh. This is, again, one of the many, many differences between Stanford and Medtronic, is that there are short-term expectations that require people to really work at a very high level. And the people are working so hard, really. I mean, I get email at 2 a.m. from engineers, they're not working on an hourly rate, they're exempt employees. So the people are working very hard to meet these short-term expectations, and to some degree, this is good. This is how products come out. And there should be an expectation, and there should be accountability.
You said to me once that actually it was the financial side of things that as a physician was most interesting to you, but should we also detect a note of frustration in your voice, or does it come with the territory?
I'm not frustrated for a minute. I mean, I have a phenomenal opportunity. It's hard. And to me, you know, it's not for wimps. You've got to be willing to fight for what you want, and we do fight. But frustration, no. Nah.
We've run long, and I do want to open up for a Q&A. Yeah. Let me ask you one other question. I don't even know how to put the time frame on this, but how do you think Medtronic will be a different company 5 to 6 years from now, 10 to 12 years, whatever time frame you want, both as a result of your efforts and your influence and as a result of kind of broader macro influences?
So I get asked this a lot, and the question is, I mean, how do you go from what you are? So first of all, the company does really well. I think everyone knows this. We're one of a handful of companies like this in the history of American commerce. We put out double-digit growth year after year after year. We put $700 million a quarter in the bank as free cash flow. There's nothing wrong with the story as it is. So imagine you go into these guys who are pouring out $700 million a quarter of free cash flow, and you say, nice idea, all wrong. I think the company should be completely different. And they, of course, doesn't exactly perfectly resonate. But so what I try to help is say, look, you know, 50 years from now, this company is going to look like this. And so the question is, how do you bring it along without killing this thing that it is? And that's, of course, the beauty of big companies, and I'm the last person to talk about it. But I'm trying to help. So the way the company, I think, is going to look different, I think this is the way the device world is going to look different, and Paul and I talked about this today, is how I would encourage biodesign to be different. Is I think 15 years from now, Medtronic is going to look an awful lot like Amgen, and Amgen is going to look an awful lot like Medtronic, and these companies are going to be collaborating in bringing biologics to functional restoration, and it's going to involve very high-end imaging and navigation technology. Because in order to restore things that are dysfunctional, you have to be able to see them as dysfunctional. And it'll be real time with MR, I don't know. But so the company's going to look a lot like a biotech company, because there'll be a lot of combination devices. The other major thing that I think is going to happen, and there's no better place for it to happen than here on this campus, in my opinion, is this convergence of devices with communication and information technology. So our ability to use implanted sensor technology monitoring physiologic function will move from what it has historically been in devices, which is closed-loop systems, which would sense and actuate devices, classic example, pacemaker, sense pace, glucose sensor, driving a pump, moving from these closed-loop engineering solutions to broadband solutions that will allow for patient management. So our ability to take a patient with diabetes and have that not only information going to their pump, but going to their BlackBerry, having this sent broadband through secured networks to data storage where we write the software for looking at trends for individualized patients that then comes back to this patient in meaningful ways will define the company, I think. And so what I tell them is that 15 years from now, we're going to be a service company.
And do you, Steve Oshley, need to be there to make that work happen at Medtronic, or is it wired into where Medtronic is going today?
Well, you know, I have a mandatory retirement at 65. I'm 56. So I won't probably be there for all of this, David. No, I'm not. I'm just a regular guy there just trying to cause trouble. But somebody's got to be pushing this story. And so, you know, it's one of my privileges.
Great. Steve, thank you very much. Yeah. It's been really fascinating. I wish we had two more hours, but let me, in this spirit of this open dialogue, invite you to the microphone. And while people are moving to the microphone, let me ask a question. I know one of the big issues for biotech device companies, you alluded to it a little bit, are the kind of cultural differences that loom large. As you pointed out to me, oftentimes devices are all about small R and big D, rapid product iterations. Pharma just the opposite. And then there are scale issues. Medtronic's an $11 billion company. Lipitor is a $13, $14 billion company, and Plavix isn't much smaller than that. I know you spend a lot of time thinking about the difference between biopharma and device as kind of industry segments. Are collaborations between the two possible?
Well, they're very different cultures, you're right. And again, Paul and I were laughing about this a little bit today, too. And I wanted to ask Will Sampson this question, so I'll turn it around. Is it One of the biggest differences I see between the device world, the farmer world, and culture is that there's this sense of, in the farmer world, of this bench to bedside concept. You all hear it. You hear it everywhere. It's on Paul's wall down in his office. And it was the first thing that caught my eye. I said, Paul, what's this bench to bedside thing? Because that's sort of the credo of pharma. And so they have all these scientists doing combinatorial chemistry, and they have targets, and they mix and match, and one day they go, Eureka, we think we have something here, and they do some animal trials, and they translate this out to the bedside eventually. So it does go bench to bedside, and the physicians really are not necessary for any part of this. And so they are, in my opinion, customers of this event. Contrast that, if you will, to the culture of the device world, where, and this is where I'm going to ask you the question, Will, if I went to Medtronic and looked at our top 100 products across the whole pantheon of products and said to the product managers, where did the concept for this product come from? With no exception, it came from a physician struggling at the bedside to try to solve a problem and couldn't quite figure it out, and they would articulate it to a salesperson or to a rep, and they would prototype something, try to figure something out, and then they would iterate it back and forth. So it invariably always started at the bedside, went to the bench, back and forth, iterated, which is why the move in the federal government to disarticulate physicians from the device world is a disaster for the device world. It's really irrelevant, in my opinion, to the pharma world, and probably should happen. So I noticed that Stanford cut off lunches or something here from pharma, good idea. But the you cannot disarticulate physicians from the device world. It'll kill it. And this is a culture, that, again, so that is really, really different. And so I asked Paul, I can only think of one device, Will, that an engineer invented without physician conceptual input that was any good. And that was Rotablator, but maybe you can come up with something else. But for example, cardiogenesis may have been an engineering idea, and well, it should have been, because it was wacky from start to finish. And so don't write that.
No, that one I'll leave out.
So, because it's a public company. Is it public? I think it is. Yeah, so, well, if you can tell me if you can think of a one that was pure engineering, but it's rare. Yeah, great. So that culture is really hard to kind of work with pharma on. The other thing is ambiguity.
Right.
When we start a project, a product cycle time, there isn't any ambiguity about what's going to happen at the end. You know from the start that it's going to work because it's an engineering thing. Every once in a while, you get surprised. So, Josh Macauer, where are you, Josh? He's back. So this is the biggest surprise of my career, which was that Josh Macauer, by the way, he tried to say that didn't start at the bedside, but I said, you are a physician. But he came up with, I think, the best idea I've ever seen in a device, which was transvascular. And, you know, they don't always work. But for the most part, that will work someday, by the way, but for the most part, devices are very predictable, which is why you can do MPV in our business and get away with it. But this is how you get minus 300 when you try to get away from it, because once it gets beyond 36 months, it's incomprehensible to device people. And so getting that culture together where you get Genzyme and Medtronic and we decide to stop the clinical trial, and Art thinks that's the end of the joint venture. You know, it didn't work. And these guys are happy as ever. I mean, you know, just science for science sake, we're going to charge on. So these kind of cultures of ambiguity and uncertainty are so different.
Well, just add that. One of the things that we found at Wendover is a lot of interest in the device community in the notion of convergence and collaborations with biotech. But when you talk to biotech companies, and maybe some of these scale issues, they're a lot less enthusiastic. I mean, somebody once said to me about a company that I thought was a classic candidate, you know, why would I want to do a $30 million deal with Boston Scientific when I can do a $300 million deal with Bristol Myers Squibb? Do you sense, you said the Genzyme and Alnylam came to Medtronic, but do you sense, as you talk to biotech groups, because I know you talk to a lot of biotech groups, that that there's much interest in their part in doing collaboration?
There's a lot of interest. Again, the fundamental problem, if you want to call it that, is the scale of investment. Because they're glad to collaborate, but they want you to pay your way, right? And so, again, we're used to paying $50 million to bring a device out, you know. And so that doesn't do bupkis for them. And so I think that this is where, again, we didn't get into this. This is where private equity is sort of finding its way into the device world, is that the scale of investment is so large,
right,
to do these combination devices that most device companies aren't prepared to contemplate it. And so you're going to see, I think, some creative financing, legal creative financing, but you'll see some interesting financing going on that will triangulate devices, pharma, and venture money, private equity of one kind or another. I don't know, Brad, do you think that's reasonable?
Great. Well, we really are up against time. I don't see anybody coming to the microphone, so I'm going to unilaterally end it there. It's been a fascinating session. I think we've just begun to tap the insights that Steve has. Steve, thank you very much.
Thank everybody for coming. My God, I can't imagine why you're here, but thank you very much.